Matthew chapter 2, we are here in our second week looking at the Gospel of Matthew, and we're looking at a couple of episodes in Jesus' life that we normally associate with the Christmas story. But we're going to find tonight that I'm not sure that they necessarily are connected to the sentimental kind of have a happy Christmas that we want to connect them to, particularly when you see all that happens. We have the Magi, but we also have some despots, particularly one. Actually, there's a couple. There's a number of despots in our passage we're going to read about. And then Jesus on the run, being a refugee, nowhere to lay his head. That's not something. Yeah, just a wicked ruler. Just a ruthless, wicked ruler. Thank you. Did you get it?
No. Did you say, I wanted him to define despot, Kayla, the countermans, but they might not have ever heard that term.
Thank you.
Yeah, despots. Depending on who you're talking to and what their political opinions are. Right. So we got baby on the run. Now, the way to really keep in mind how the story's unfolding before us is to consider that we're looking at Matthew in three parts from this time he began to teach, and then we go into the major sections of his teaching from this time he began to speak of his passion in chapter 16. So prior to chapter 4, where the teachings begin, we're introduced to Jesus in six distinct episodes. Last week we looked at the opening chapter, his genealogy and birth, and you may recall that Matthew makes no bones about it. None of our gospel writers want to offer any of us the luxury of option of figuring out who Jesus is for ourselves. They want to tell us who Jesus is and challenge us to encounter the Jesus they've encountered. They all know that Jesus is bigger than the Jesus they're telling us of. That's why there's four gospels. But they don't ever say, you know, I'm not sure if he's Messiah or not. Matthew comes out all guns blazing. Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And before the chapter's over, he's Emmanuel, the virgin conceived one, the beginning of a new Genesis. A new Genesis that begins by building off that old genealogy so that what God is doing in Christ is not completely new and uprooted from what's happened in our Old Testament. It is actually the fulfillment of that and then the beginning of a new way in and through Jesus. And then we looked last week at the birth, and that birth story, I hope that I popped a few bubbles, because the birth story really isn't about Jesus' birth as much as it is trying to overcome the problem of the virgin conception, that Jesus is the son of Mary, and the only way he can be in the Davidic line in Matthew's gospel is if Joseph adopts him and takes him as his own. There's all kinds of obstacles to Joseph doing that, but Joseph being a righteous man, open to a new righteousness that goes beyond the law, is not afraid to take Mary as his wife and transgress the law of Moses in doing that. And so, here we move then into the middle section of this introduction, the journey of the Magi and the flight to and from Egypt. And the thing that I hope to convince you of and convey before we're done tonight is simply this. So if you keep this message or this question in mind, you'll be able to see where I'm trying to lead this whole discussion tonight. And that is, and this is how I was taught by my gospel professor, imagine what would happen if you were to remove those two episodes. What would you be missing? Because once you can discern what you'd be missing, you're understanding why Matthew has it there in the first place. Why doesn't Matthew go from the birth of Jesus right to Jesus' adult life, and he's baptized, and then into his testing in the wilderness and right into his public ministry? Why does he tell us about these two events with Jesus as a child, the visit of the Magi, Herod's rage toward the Messiah, and then the flight to and from Egypt, and finally landing the family in Nazareth? Why does he do that? And I'd like you to consider that as we go through this entire chapter, because I would suggest when you start thinking like that, you're starting to think more in line with how the Gospels want to unfold. They want to unfold in a way that we see that every piece matters. That you can't take a commercial break. You can't edit this out. That there's a reason why Matthew chose to include this. And it wasn't just because he had some scroll room and wanted to, you know, add some more words per document. He's putting this there for a specific reason. So, let's begin our story and note that in order to get this story, we got to move away from the nativity scenes, Because what we're encountering is Jesus, who's already been born, and he's in Bethlehem at home. He's not at the manger. He's at his house, the way Matthew wants to tell it. It's Joseph and Mary's house, because the way Matthew wants to tell the story, Joseph and Mary live in Bethlehem. They are going to be uprooted as refugees again and again. Their life will be brought into great conflict and tumult because of the birth of the Christ child. But they begin their time in the house at in Bethlehem, which is about 5 miles south of Jerusalem. It's, if you will, almost a suburb of Jerusalem. It's in within walking distance. So, verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." Now note, there aren't three. That comes with later tradition. The reason why we end up saying we three kings and the three magi, you know why. It's very, very simple. There are three gifts that are given, but there's no way to say, you know, the gold and the frankincense and myrrh means that there's only three. It's just the magi. It's plural. The magi from the east, and we don't even get much more than that. They're not wise men. They are probably Persian astrologers, perhaps Arabian astrologers. They know nothing of Israel's sacred tradition or scriptures. All they know is through ever, however they determined it, that God has led them by a star that has told them that the King of the Jews is to be born and they're to go worship, which is not what you do for a king in that day. They're coming to worship, which right away sets up this very odd thing that these Gentiles, these pagans, these outsiders are the first ones in Matthew's gospel to seek the King of the Jews. So this is a strange yet interesting story. And it's interesting because they go to Herod's palace. You know why you'd go to Herod's palace if you're a magi looking for the King of the Jews? Well, you'd expect the king's going to be born in a palace. So they go to Herod's place. They assume that Herod's going to have some awareness that this King of the Jews is being born and the star has come up and that there's a significant event of noteworthy value that calls them to bow and worship and give gifts and adore that they need to attend to. So they come to Herod thinking, hey, this is the palace. This must be where we're ultimately being led. Well, when they get to Herod, if you know anything about Herod, he was a great builder. He did a lot of great things. He built Masada, many fortresses. He built Caesarea. He was an incredible, extraordinary builder. He was the mastermind behind building the third temple, but taking that temple that was built under Zerubbabel and others and expanding it and making it golden and glorious. And he began that project, and it wouldn't be done till 64 AD, and then it'd be destroyed very soon after. But he was this master builder. But he was also a ruthless administrator. He was very paranoid. Anyone that he thought might be trying to get his throne, he'd kill, even if it were his own sons. And we could go on and on with stories from antiquity of him killing his sons because he suspected they wanted his throne, and then him finding out later, well, no, they really didn't. Oh, well. He's killed them anyway. And killing wives for that same purpose. He's a ruthless person, so much so that there was a saying about Herod that it's better to be Herod's pig than to be his son. Which would to say you'd have more chance of surviving if you were his pig than his own son. So we know he's paranoid. He's paranoid, and he's also hearing from them of an omen. And when you hear star in the east, keep in mind that in the ancient world, omens and stars that are guiding and directing means the heavens are at work doing something and I better pay attention. He hears this omen and he's threatened by that. But the core reason he's threatened by all of this is to keep in mind that Herod's title is King of the Jews. He's the King of the Jews. He is an Edomian, which means he's an Edomite. He is a descendant of Esau, a very close relative to Israel. You remember Jacob and Esau? I mean, they were very close. A lot of hot-headed conflict between them throughout the Old Testament, but close enough to be almost a Jew, at least ethnically down the same parallel line. But he was understood to be, because of that ethnic heritage, king of the Jews. So when he hears, being paranoid, that there's a king of the Jews being born, and he notes that there's a sign in the heavens that this is to be so, you can imagine the rage and the paranoia and the fear and the threat. And so in light of that threat, he gets religious, but not for the good reasons. Verse 3, when King Herod heard this, he was disturbed or greatly troubled. Verse 3, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked where the Christ was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. And now he's quoting, and they are quoting, Micah 5:2. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers in Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people, Israel. So he hears that Christ is to be born. He studies the scriptures, the scribes hear, and they give him this answer, which is the right answer. It's really interesting to see Herod get all religious. And, you know, if we were watching from afar, we might think, boy, he's really interested in this. Perhaps he's curious about what God may be doing, but that's not at all his intention, as we see in the remainder of this story. Verse 7, then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and make careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I may go and worship him. Fingers crossed behind the back. You know, I want to go worship him. Now, the Magi don't know any better. They don't know. I mean, as far as they're concerned, it's part of his ethnic heritage. He must be looking forward to this as much as they are. They see it as a reason to rejoice, to bring gifts, to hopefully worship. They're assuming that Herod really does intend to worship and that Herod's sending them out. But what's interesting to note, and sometimes we miss this during our Christmas studies of this passage, Herod is wanting to eliminate the threat to his kingship permanently, no matter what it takes. And he's willing to go to war against heaven itself to crush the Messiah. And you note how the powers of this world respond to the power of God's kingdom. And you find they don't all stand back and say, oh, lovely, let's all join in on what God's doing. Come on in, King of the Jews, help us run things. Instead, Herod is going to do what many do. Set himself firmly to destroy the Messiah. Do you see that? Do you get that? He knows that this is where Messiah is going to be born. He sees a sign in the heaven and he says, I'm not going to say this out loud. You guys go do my dirty work, but it's really good work because I'm going to worship. And I'm going to come and destroy him. And all of a sudden you realize how evil Herod is. But how in many ways Herod just is the beginning of many rulers and people in power who are completely upset by the message of the Christ and the means and the way of the Christ and are willing to move heaven and earth to destroy the witness of the light, to destroy the salt, to completely eliminate that which would conflict with their own desires for power. Willing to even, as we'll see in a moment, and you know the story, destroy anonymous babies as collateral damage in order to wipe out this Messiah. So we're dealing here with a very, very evil man. So, as the story goes on, we move from kind of, if the music we're playing is dun dun dun. But the music would change to lighthearted because the Magi are going to go off and they think that they're doing Herod a favor. And they actually came for this very reason. So they're ready to go back on their journey. They're glad to have heard from the scriptures that they can actually find the place where Messiah is to be born. Think about it. All they had was the star. It got them far, but it didn't get them all the way. And what they needed to get all the way was the sacred scriptures, the scriptures of Israel, the prophecies. They needed that. They wouldn't have got there without that. So they come on their own, but it is the scriptures that ultimately are that final piece of the puzzle that leads them in the right direction. So verse 9, after they'd heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they'd seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were, I love this, overjoyed, which is such an understatement, because the Greek literally says they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Rejoiced exceedingly With great joy. I mean, just joy with joy. Joy overflowing. And I think that's how the NRSV puts it. This overflowing or overwhelmed with joy. But it is this strong, emotional, overwhelming sense of joy and delight that they experience. Verse 11, on coming to, and this is important, the house. Whose house? Joseph and Mary's house. This is where they live. This is why it's going to be so traumatic for them to have to leave house and home and go to Egypt. And then want to come back to house and home and instead have to go to Hicksville. And leave where they are from. So we need to keep this in mind as we see what's going on. This is their house. So it's not the manger. It's not a nativity scene. They're coming here to the home of Joseph and Mary. And when they came to the house, verse 11, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and they worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. Now, before we see the warning that they get, I think it's vital to see that they have three incredible reactions. They're overjoyed, they worship, they give gifts. These are Gentiles. These are people outside of that community of the chosen, but they are the first ones to come and to be overjoyed and to give gifts and to worship. Worship is not something you do just for a king. You might bow down in submission, but worship is that which is only reserved for the gods or a god. It's interesting to note, by the time Matthew is done, you'll read this. And in fact, if you hold your place there and come to the end of Matthew, because it's always neat to see how things frame at the end. If we note that the Gentiles worship here at the beginning, we know that the call at the end of Matthew is to go into all the world. That means beyond the borders of Israel, into the world that is not just Israel. But you'll notice in chapter 28, the last chapter, verse 9, the women at the tomb. Everyone there? Suddenly Jesus met them. Greetings, he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. Go to verse 17. We'll put it in context with 16. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee to the mountain where Jesus had told them. When they saw him, they worshipped him. But some doubted. You need to know, Jesus is a faithful Israelite. No one should be worshipped but God. Jesus never says, don't worship me. From this point on, we are foreshadowing where this is all going to go. There are some progressive and liberal theologians that want to say, you know, Jesus never made any claims to deity, and all those times he did, that's the church just making that up. And really, you know, John talks a lot, in the beginning was the Word, and Word was with God, and the Word was God. But you know, that's John, and he's written so much later than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And I always laugh and think, I guess you guys don't know Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Because from the opening lines of Matthew, from the opening chapters, they worshipped him. Closing with, worshipped him. And those are fighting words among ancient Israelites unless we're talking about worshipping Yahweh. And so in some way, Jesus must be identified with, connected to, you know, in union with Yahweh. Emmanuel, God with us. So I think that's vital to get, because there are some that just act as if there's just a few scattered passages. It's woven and through the whole warp and woof of all of the Gospels, and here we begin to see it unfold, and it really already has God with us, but now we see it coming even further. So, the Magi have done their thing. Verse 12, and having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. So it's at that point they finally realize, oh, Herod, he's a dirtbag. He didn't really mean to come worship. We had this dream. They're faithful to the dream. They don't go back, which means they don't fear the king. They're happy not doing what he says to do. They could care less about his authority because they've been spoken to by a higher authority. And the last thing they're going to do is go back and give the whereabouts about where the Messiah is, because we know how the story's going to unfold. If the Gentiles here who came to worship had gone back and told Herod, there'd be no gospel. Because he would have come right away and killed the Christ child. That was his plan all along. So we must see, this is one of those times in a good story where the tension is ramped up and anxiety is high. And it's like, oh no, you know, don't go back and tell Herod. Don't go back and tell Herod. We know what he's going to do. He's a bad guy. He's pretending to be good. He's bad. But they're warned by God in a dream not to go. They don't go. And so the Christ child will survive, but unfortunately there'll be a lot of collateral damage because Herod, once he realizes his plans have gone amiss, is still going to do everything he can to destroy the Christ child. And so that's how the story continues on. Before we get to that part of the story, though, it's interesting to recognize that there's this old mosaic that I have here at the background that you've been looking at for a while, and it gives you kind of the main characters of the story so far. We have the chief priest and the scribes, the religious professionals and scholars. We have Herod and his Roman cohorts. And then we have the Gentile pagans. And what's interesting about the story so far, if you wanted to apply it to yourself personally, the only persons on this that don't have connection to scriptures are the pagans. The religious scholars have the scriptures. They know them so well, they know where Messiah is going to be born. But they don't go to check it out. Do you see that? And then Herod, he's very interested. Why? To use them to his own advantage. He's very interested in Bible study as long as he can twist it to make it satisfy his own desires for power and gain. And the ones who are finally introduced to the sacred scriptures, after this yearning and desiring to find and worship the King of the Jews, are the ones that actually fulfill and satisfy what God intends with all the scriptures anyway. What God intends is that the scriptures would lead us to worship of God, to trust in God, to Mission Impossible. All right, it's a great theme. It's one of the best. It's a nice ringtone. Sorry. Sorry, music does that to me. It just gets me in there. That's a great, great theme. It probably goes along with our text. You could probably keep it running, and it would go along with at least somewhere in what we're looking at. But I think that's interesting. And when you and I as believers are trying to not just learn about Jesus, but to follow Jesus, not to just hear the scriptures and learn them in education for information, we're trying to be formed by the scriptures, is important to note all the ways scripture can go wrong. We can be incredibly schooled in it and be completely indifferent. We can know the right passages and use them in all the wrong ways, or we can know just one. Micah 5:2 is all they had, and it led them into the very heart of God. One passage. That was just enough to get them in the right direction and lead them on the right path in a way that will show itself to be the right response to Jesus before this book is done. There's one other thing that's amazing about these Gentile pagans, and it comes through in an old quote I have from a guy named J.C. Ryle. He's a preacher that preached about the same time Spurgeon did at the end of the 19th century. And he writes this: "The conduct of the wise men is a striking example of faith. They believed in Christ when they'd never seen him, but that was not all. They believed in him when they saw him a little infant on Mary's knee and worshipped him as a king. This was the crowning point of their faith. They saw no miracles to convince them. They heard no teaching to persuade them. They beheld no signs of divinity and greatness to overawe them. They saw nothing but a newborn infant, helpless and weak, and needing a mother's care like any one of ourselves. And yet when they saw that infant, they believed that they saw the divine Savior of the world. They fell down and worshipped him." We read of no greater faith than this in the whole volume of the Bible. It really is amazing to think they didn't see much, and yet they worshipped, they adored, they were overjoyed. Now, when you say things like there's no greater faith, that's preacher's words. You know, we say that all the times this is the greatest, and that is a great one. I think there's a greater one, and it's when, you know, because at the end of the day, when you see a baby, there's at least the promise of life. And you don't know where it's going. And then you think, if this child could become anything, who knows how this child will change the world. But when you are a crucified criminal hanging on a stake and the powers of the occupying government have completely overwhelmed you and you are dying on a cross, and a thief turns to you and says, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." When he says, "You have a kingdom, you must be king, and you can save me." I think that's actually the triumph of faith with very little evidence whatsoever. Because then there seems to be no hope. A baby at least offers the possibility of hope. a crucified criminal offers no hope unless you have amazing faith. But that's another story. We'll get to that when we get to that story. All right? So, let's make our way quickly through the remainder of this, because this is really one of the... It's a chase from here on out. So, Mission Impossible music comes on. It's a total chase now from this point on, with a little bit of action and slaughter thrown in. Joseph has a dream. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. We already know that. We've seen that. His plot is thwarted a bit. So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother during the night. That very moment, he got the dream and it's like, okay, obey. It also shows how urgent. I mean, if I, you know, all really knew, you know, your wife and kids are under threat, you'd probably, as quickly as you could, get out of there. And that's what he's doing there. And so he leaves, and where for? Egypt. Egypt? Why Egypt? I mean, that's a long, we're talking hundreds of miles. It's not like, you know, hiding out in a cave somewhere. It's going way far away, which means the threat is great. He stayed there until the death of Herod, and so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet. And here's our second quotation. Out of Egypt I called my son, which connects Jesus to the people of Israel under the oppression of Egypt, who are in Egypt but will eventually be called out of Egypt. Verse 16, when Herod realized that he'd been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. Curses! Foiled again! You know, that's what he's doing, but he's furious. And he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet was fulfilled. Now, this isn't as if this had to be fulfilled and God makes sure this happens. What we're reading about here is the lamentation of the people in Jerusalem when their children are devastated in the exile. And now we see that that cry of Israel continues on for its children and all the violence that surrounds it. And so we have the voice of Ramah crying and the women are weeping, and you have this horrendous slaughter in Israel. What this is meant to show us is the brutality and viciousness of Herod, and that he is willing to go to every end to destroy Messiah. He is willing to do that. Now, he's willing to do that, but Herod, no matter what he thinks of himself, has a vulnerability. And that's verse 19. And Herod died. Boom. And what you get there is just, I honestly think that's Matthew's way of saying, see what a threat this guy is, see the viciousness, see the brutality. He is a horrendously evil and unjust, ruthless man. But you know what? The kings of this earth perish, the word of the Lord goes on. God's word even goes on in the midst of this suffering. That the Christ who's come to us, the God who's come to us in this Christ, has come to enter into our sufferings and to share those and to enter into the vulnerability of childhood and the challenge of running for your life from oppressive powers that may seek to undo you. So all of a sudden, Herod dies. And an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, take the child, his mother, go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead. That means Herod's dead. So, Joseph gets up, he takes Mary back, hopefully to go to Bethlehem. That's where they left home and hearth. But, when he gets there, verse 21, he took the child, his mother, went to the land of Israel. When he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judah in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Now, this is Archelaus. Archelaus is one of three of Herod's sons that fought over and eventually landed with having different areas that they were over and in charge of. You have different areas here, here, and here. Now, the only one that matters in our story is Archelaus, because he ends up having dominion after Herod dies, and there's the struggle over Herod's reign, over Samaria, Judea, and Idumea. He does not have rulership over Galilee. It's just these three land areas, and there's where Bethlehem is, right under Jerusalem. So he's the guy there. Archelaus, when he began his reign, massacred 3,000 right away just to show his power. Just, you know, I'm in charge here. Don't anybody mess with me. His brutality was so intolerable that 2 years later, the powers that be in Rome took him out. They deposed him of his rule, and Judah and Samaria, those regions, were made into a Roman province over which a Roman procurator, not someone of Edomite blood, closely associated ethnically with Israel, someone of Roman blood was brought in, and Rome would take charge over Judah and Idumea. And it's because of that that we end up in our Jesus story with Pontius Pilate as the procurator of the area. There's a reason why Herod has no authority, because there's a family of Herods. The Herod's other Herod brothers and sons don't have authority over Judea, and that is because Rome is given direct authority precisely because of Archelaus, who ruins his opportunity because he's so bloodthirsty. All right, you following there? So that's why Pilate ends up in the picture later on, because of Rome's authority and direct rule in that area. But ultimately, that leads us to Jesus landing in Nazareth, which would never be expected of Messiah. All of the prophets understood Jesus, or not Jesus, but when Messiah comes, Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. But since Bethlehem's only 5 miles south of Jerusalem, they'd assume, well, Jerusalem will be the place where the action happens, because that's the place that matters. It's where the temple is. It's where all the religiously important things happen. So Messiah's got to be, you know, like a New York City boy or an L.A. boy. He's got, or Chicago, and the place that matters, not Paducah, Kentucky. Or maybe even worse. Paducah's actually a nice town. I've been there. I've played there. I can't think of another one that's, you know...
Cudahy.
Well, let's say Slinger. I don't know. I'm just trying to think of a small town that I know of. Slinger's what, about 9,000? And Bethlehem or Nazareth? Actually, Nazareth's about 500 to 2,000. So
Newburgh.
All right, there you go. Anyone from Newburgh? Anyone from Newburgh? Okay. Okay, but you're not from Newburgh, so we'll use Newburgh. Okay, Newburgh. All right. Nothing wrong with that. Jesus is from Newburgh in our story, all right? So nothing wrong with that. But what our story ends up with is how Jesus lands there. So, he hears about Archelaus, having been warned in a dream, verse 22b, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. That's where Archelaus has no authority. And he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, he'll be called a Nazarene. Now what's interesting is no prophet says that. And so most scholars will say this is an interesting pun off of the word Nazir, which has two associations. There were the Nazarites, the people that made a vow to God, so they'd never cut their hair, they'd never drink wine, and they were wholly devoted unto God. The never cutting your hair part's awesome. I think that's an awesome part of that vow. Samson was one of those. Never drinking wine, it all depends on your taste. So you have the Nazarites, and then you also have Nazir, Nazaret, which is the Hebrew word for branch. And Jesus is the branch of David. So they say that what you get is this playful pun off of this holy one, this devoted one, this Nazarite, who is a Nazaret, who's a branch, the branch of David, the son of David, and Nazareth kind of connects to all of that. All of that's important for a reason, which I'll give in just a moment, because we've got to be done here real soon. We've looked at the passage. We've considered these two sections. The initial question I approached you with was, what would we be missing? What would be gone from the story that now we know is an essential part of the story, had Matthew moved right from the birth to Jesus' adult years and into his testing and then public ministry? Because let's face it, Mark just starts right there with baptism. He doesn't do any of this. So what special things might be lost? And any answer is going to be fine. We're just kind of looking. Yeah, back there. Simon, is that you, Simon?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was linking Jesus to Moses and how the Israelites were banished from Israel and how likewise Jesus was sent away from his hometown.
Very good. Now I hope you followed what Simon's saying, because what we're going to see, the big word for it, the 50-cent word, is Jesus recapitulates, which means he lives again the story, but he lives the story right. because Israel was called to live a certain way and they failed again and again, but they were called to be faithful to their calling. And Moses, being a chief leader, was part of that living it out. So that if you follow the story how it unfolds, if you think about it with the Magi, the story of Moses and the story of Herod are identical. A brutal, ruthless leader destroys all the young male children in the community of Israel. And in Moses' story, he's saved by the faithfulness of his parents. In Jesus' story, he's saved by the faithfulness of his parents. Then you have Moses, who's in Egypt, who leaves Egypt, but then goes back to Egypt and then brings the people out of Egypt with him. How did they get out of Egypt? Well, ultimately, once they leave, the Pharaoh and his cohorts follow, but they escape through the waters. And it's through the waters that are delivered, and that becomes a defining moment where God saves when they couldn't on their own, which baptism, at least in one sense, draws attention to. God saves when we can't. And then, ultimately, then we move into, just like Israel, just like Moses, testing in the wilderness. 40 years for them, 40 days for Jesus. All in order to establish that Jesus is the new Moses, but he's living the story of Moses, but now he's going to live it to the full. And that he is also the embodiment of Israel, the true Israelite, the one who will faithfully not only experience the sorrow and suffering of the Pharaoh, not only go to Egypt, but he will identify with the baptism, be saved through the washing, I must do this for the sake of righteousness. He will perfectly go through the temptations. He will not falter in one iota, setting the stage for the remainder of his ministry so that he can be the true Israelite, the truly blessed one, the one that's living God's call, living God's will, and so forth, and thus be the Israelite through whom God's blessing comes to the world. So very good, Simon. That's one thing you wouldn't get at all, because we wouldn't know of the suffering. You go right from the birth to baptism, no suffering, there's no conflict. We don't know of anything that ever hardship Jesus went through. He might have had an idyllic life for all we know and just had a wonderful home life and everything was good. But we know, oh no, there's a lot of suffering. There's refugees, they're on the run, they're scared, they're moving from place to place. They're under threat. We also know this from the beginning, but maybe some of you have this. There's a couple other things that we wouldn't get if we missed those chapters. Yeah.
They shouldn't be concerned with babies being born, even if it's the Son of God, because they don't know it's the Son of God and the Gentiles.
Okay.
Also, Gentiles, it's like power, the lowly, and the unreligious. Like two opposites.
Okay.
Jesus. To Egypt, you have to understand the this is really far away. I'm pretty sure they're not Catholic. I'm a Christian. Are they?
No. There's no Christians yet. Okay, let me connect to one of the things you said, because you said a lot. One of the things that clearly we get here that we would not get, and you touched on it, is we have Gentiles worshiping in an instance where you'd expect that Herod or the scribes or the people who know their scriptures would be. But instead it's the Gentiles. So we have this very interesting irony that the first to worship and show and express devotion to Christ are not the faithful and devout of Israel. It is the Gentiles. Which, of course, that's where our story is going to unfold and go to. And Egypt is far, far away. I had a map somewhere that shows how far Egypt is away. There's Bethlehem, there's Nazareth. Long, long journey that these guys went on. Okay, for the sake of time, we need to go very quickly now for any others, because I want to touch on one more and I'm done. Simon. Okay, good.
And then again from the sheet, we find that the people that accept Jesus as the Messiah tend to be the unimportant, disliked, the people that are very low in society.
All right, very, very good. Tell me the first part again. I'm so hot up here. Is it hot in here? Are we burning alive in here? Does someone... what was the first thing you said, Simon? Because I'm just, as you were saying it, I'm thinking I'm so hot.
The first thing was all the suffering that's...
Okay, good. It foreshadows the suffering to come. We would not have that. Let me go back to the chart we have. We would not have an idea that Jesus is going to be the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. That's not just true in Jesus' public ministry. That's true of his childhood. The idea that his family's on the run, they have to uproot, they have to leave their life as they know it, that they have to live out of a backpack and just be on the run. The fact that Jesus is experiencing this in his family, and then as he grows up in his public ministry, the same people he ministers are those same ones on the margin, the outsiders, the people that don't have much. You get this clear sense that the one who's come, God with us, is with us in our sufferings, in our challenges, in our trials, and identifies from the beginning, from his birth, he is the man of sorrows acquainted with grief. From the beginning. It's not just his teaching that causes that to happen. It's who he is. It's who he is. And that's important. Because he's not just a great teacher. He's Emmanuel. And that's why Herod hates him. All right, one last one, and it's so clear there. If you don't get it, I got to move on. What is it?
Another thing that it handles with soup is with the scholars in Herod.
Uh-huh. Yes, that's right. Good. That's such a good point. I let you make it anyway, even though that's not it. Here it is. You ready? Conflict and struggle from the beginning, identification with sorrows, but here's what I gave and you heard Simon refer to it. I gave them all a study sheet, the confirmands, and I asked them to think through some questions. And one of the most important reasons that Matthew 2 is here is not just to show us Jesus' identification with suffering, not to show just his conflict and struggle from the beginning, not just to show the Gentiles worshiping from the beginning, but there's four quotes from the Old Testament. Every single one of them has an address. Every single one has a location. So if you look at verse 5, but you, Bethlehem. If you look at verse 15, out of Egypt. If you look at verse 18, a voice is heard in Ramah. That's a place right outside Jerusalem. And then it ends with the made-up prophecy. He shall be a Nazarene. And what Matthew wants to say is, okay, I know everyone expects Messiah to be working around Jerusalem because he's going to be born in Bethlehem just 5 miles south of Jerusalem. But the reason why we find our Messiah hanging mostly in Capernaum and Galilee, up by the Sea of Galilee, in the place where there's a bunch of Gentiles and backwoods folk and people even considered not truly Jewish. The reason why he's up there is because of Matthew 2, that he had to escape to Egypt. And he actually came back to live here and was going to stay there, but Archelaus was ruling, and so Joseph took him up to Nazareth, and there he stay until the time when he comes to reveal himself with John the Baptist. But when it comes to hometown for Jesus, he'll come down here on occasion, but this is where most of the ministry is going to happen. And Matthew wants us to see that's why that happens that way. That's why it doesn't all happen in Bethlehem and Jerusalem. That's why Jesus is Jesus of Nazareth. And that's the story he wants us to get before we move right into the adult years. Because in the next turn of a sentence, fast forward 30 years. Boom. And all of a sudden, Jesus is encountering John the Baptist. Now,